Now to this course. Many, but not all of you, will have heard Julian David speak before. Educated at Oxford, he spent 2 years in the training for Dominican friars, and then 5 years in training to become a Jungian analyst at the Jung Institute in Zurich. He practices in London and Devon, where he lives, but has extensive connections with South Africa, where he's lectured a great deal, including at summer school, and has been involved in training programs, exercising a significant influence over the development of Jungian ideas and analytic practice here. We're lucky to have him here at this time of the year to talk about an epic that is much studied from literary, historical, and mythological perspectives. Julian will reflect on the tradition from which it derives, its mystery and authority, and its meaning as a key psychological text. Please welcome Julian David. I said, welcome, Julian David. Move it slightly up there. Is someone at the back for monitoring? There's nothing in the front one. So you check. Thanks.
Is this audible? Can you hear me? Can you hear me now? Oh, okay. I want to dedicate these lectures. I don't usually dedicate lectures. But I want to dedicate these.
Sorry, could you please put the microphone closer to you? More central. Yes.
Like that? Okay. I don't often dedicate lectures, but I want to dedicate these lectures to the memory of Stephen Watson, a great friend to me and to many in this room, in the true sense of the word great, a very big soul. The quintessential poet of Cape Town, in all its bleakness and its beauty, which he will remain, and an exquisitely honest thinker, and driven by an intensity of passion that was in the end too much. I don't know how many of you do know Stephen, but many of you will know his books and his poetry, if not. There is, I believe and have observed, an energy which comes back into this world when one, an energy as great as his, goes out of it. I dare to hope that a little bit of it might even be here today. The Myth of Gilgamesh. Written about 2,500 years BC, discovered in a lot of broken tablets in the desert about the middle of the 19th century. It took about 60 years for people to get their heads around it and translate it. And it began to trickle into our consciousness in the rendered piece by piece from these broken clay tablets, inscribed in the earliest and most mysterious of any script. But they greeted it when it came through with enormous enthusiasm, because this was the voice of man as hero. And 2,000 years before him, it seemed to reinforce the hero as the fundamental nature of man. From the opening of the poem, we note that there are armies fighting, that the great Gilgamesh is a warlord, and that like him, the gods are male, and if female, in the service of the male. It is the full-blown patriarchy in its first manifestation. And Araru, the mother of creation, has made, to the order of the father god Anu, this huge and perfect man. Designed his body, made him the strongest of men, huge, handsome, radiant, perfect. We soon learn that he is the king of Uruk, the biggest of a group of cities in the lower part of Mesopotamia, which we call Sumer. And a male so absolute that the whole female population of the city, symbolically at least, belongs to him. so that the men who marry them are in effect his tenants, and that every lawful marriage must stand aside until he has come, for all maidenheads belong to him. This went right through the patriarchal aristocratic period under the name of the droit de seigneur, the lord's right, or the jus primae noctis. How much it was ever put into practice, we don't know. But it was the idea. But problems have risen, because since nothing could oppose him, he has no limit at all. Excuse me. He struts through a rook, trampling its citizens like a wild bull. He takes the son from his father and crushes him. He takes the girl from her mother and uses her. The warrior's daughter, the young man's bride. He uses her. No one dares to oppose him. So the people cry out, and Anu commands Araru, the mother, to make another man as strong as Gilgamesh, who will be his second self. Let them balance each other, he says, so Uruk has peace. Now, that's a curious solution, you may think. Certainly not a natural one. But then none of the things that Gilgamesh are going to do are natural. That's the whole point. In nature, the man is balanced by the female. But this is patriarchy in its fullest sense. And nature is no longer a teacher. So Araru obediently makes another man of great size, with muscles like iron, and puts him out in the desert to eat grass, run with the antelope, drink at the water holes, and have no knowledge of women at all. And Gilgamesh must somehow be told about this. So he has a dream that this is his destined friend and helpmate, with whom he will form the greatest male friendship in myth. Not uniquely, because there's Saul and David later on, and there's Achilles and Patroclus. And some of you may know about that tradition in classical Greece, where two best friends, two lovers, best friends, we don't know, never quite know what lover means, would fight together, train together, go to battle together, die together. And for them, war was the greatest test and glory of the male. And after war, of course, the games. And from the meeting of Gilgamesh and Enkidu onwards, it is quite remarkable that there's no more mention in the whole poem of the love of women. Now, we know, I've long known, I didn't sort of let it really sink in, I've long known that in the Greek world, which was getting on for 2,000 years later, an ideal of love would still rule in which women simply had no part. They were good for bearing children and looking after the house, but not for love. That was for men. Unless they were like Diotima, who some of you will remember is the friend and teacher of Socrates. Because she, of course, had mastered the principles of spiritual love by means of philosophy. This a woman might do even better than a man, but there were not many could. In general, they were in the grip of nature, and nature was now a foe, quite unable to transcend the disadvantage of their sex, which was simply that enmeshment in nature. But what do we make of the next incident, you see? It's in a way, there are opposite forces going through this poem, which is the strongest possible statement of the opposite, of woman as teacher and civilizer, like nature itself is teacher and civilizer in that tradition. It comes out of the culture previous to the coming of the kings. The kings had arrived about 300 years before Gilgamesh. The dynastic period began in 3000 BC in both Egypt and Sumer as a response to very severe invasions of warrior tribes from the east. And then the whole texture of society changed. The king comes and everything in the society changes. But when Gilgamesh hears of the giant man and knows from his dream that he is his destined friend, he doesn't know how to get him into the city. That's his problem. He doesn't send out a regiment of men. They probably wouldn't work. He sends out a woman. And she is a priestess of the temple, skilled in the arts of love, and herself the supreme symbol of the old culture, mediator to the goddess. Go to the temple, he says, and ask for a woman named Shamhat, one of the priestesses who give their bodies in honor of the goddess. The idea of prostitution was absolutely different to our idea of prostitution. It was that the sacred virgin, in that sense, was the sort of stood-in for the goddess, as it were. It was basically a sacred thing. Whether it worked out like that, we don't know. But it's very different to how we think of it. Take her out into the wilderness, and when the animals come to the waterhole, and the wild man with them, let her take off her robe and lie there, and he will approach her. Nature will take its course, and the wild animals will desert him, and he will really have no recourse but to come into the city. And so it happens. She and the wild man make love for a whole week, and he, in typical Superman mode, and again, you don't have to take this literally, stays erect for all the time. At the end of which he can't run with the antelope anymore, understandably. But somehow his mind has expanded. He knows things that animals can't know. With any myth, folk tale, dream, or even our fantasies, the last thing we should ever do is to take it literally. Or rather, the first thing we do, but it's the last thing we should do, because we always miss the point. Now, animals know all about sex and propagation, but in the instinctual way that animals know it. They don't know they know. If you can take that into consciousness, into human consciousness, then you've got something worth having. Let him learn, says Gilgamesh, what a woman is. Not what she does or says, but what she is. That's a whole world. The week-long session that Shamhat gives to Enkidu, and it's a metaphor for a long time spent learning from her, expands his mind. It is the tutelage of nature, and a conscious nature is what the priestess represents in that culture. Nothing less, thinks Gilgamesh, would bring him to the city. Now that you know what a woman is, she says to him afterwards, let me take you to the city and show it to you. And you see, she won't show him the city as we think of it, historically we think of it, the glories of triumphs of generals returning to Rome, the trains of captive chieftains led through the streets in chains, all those prisoners set to work on ever more magnificent buildings, all that stuff. Later on, of course, if you go to London, you'll find statues all over the place of generals. And then you have Waterloo Station and Trafalgar Square. And in Paris, of course, you have the Gare d'Austerlitz and many others. What she will show him is the city as a place where everyone enjoys themselves. That is, for her, what the city is about. It's about living life pleasurably. I will lead you to Gilgamesh, the mighty king. You will see the great city with its mighty wall. You will see the young men dressed in their splendor. in the finest linen and embroidered wool, brilliantly coloured with fringed shawls and wide belts. Every day is a festival in Uruk, with people singing and dancing in the streets, musicians playing their lyres and drums, the lovely priestesses standing before the temple of Ishtar, chatting and laughing, flushed with joy and ready to serve men's pleasure in honour of the goddess, so that even old men are aroused from their beds. Now, there's still this tradition in some places in India, and I know somebody who did a sort of thesis about it. And of course, it doesn't always work out well at all, the tradition of the sacred priestesses, because nothing is perfect. But it is a completely different ideal to the military one. And if we ask ourselves today, what is the essence of consciousness, can we leave out the growth of the heart, the degree that we have penetrated into the erotic mystery of being, that things exist, that they are? It was only Jung in modern times who insisted that a value judgment, a felt value of things, is essential to any real consciousness, to any act of consciousness. And that you could know everything about the world, and if the heart was unmoved, it was as nothing. The whole realm of feeling has long suffered the banishment of nature itself, a considered chaos. And it was he who insisted on bringing it back into the dialogue. But Enkidu, the giant man, does like the sound of it, and the animals have indeed abandoned him. Anyone who can't hear me, please tell me. If I'm snorting too loud, you can tell me too. And before they set off, they meet a man who's on his way to a wedding in the city and tells them how it will be. How, after the feasting, the husband will stand aside until Gilgamesh has come to take his dues. And at this, Enkidu's face clouds over. Not, I think, with outrage for the woman, but for the overwhelming power of this king. And when they get, he must meet him, he says, and show him that he, Enkidu, is the greatest, and not him. And when they get into the city, and Gilgamesh arrives at the marriage house, Enkidu is there blocking his way like a great boulder. They bristle like dogs, hurl themselves upon each other. Huge arms grip huge arms. Foreheads crack like wild bulls. Up and down the streets they fight, rebounding off the walls, until at last Gilgamesh throws the wild man and pins him to the ground. And at once the anger fades in both of them, and they embrace and kiss, hold hands like brothers, and walk side by side. What has happened there? There has been a mystical-seeming experience of some sort. I think we could almost call it the mysticism of power. Something more important to them than the love of women, which of course is about being, it's about babies, it's about the creation of life. Power is the power to destroy. And I was rather disturbed when I read about a journalist talking confidentially to soldiers in Iraq, British soldiers, Scots Guardsmen or something like that. And they said, God, you know, there's nothing like a firefight. It beats sex. Absolutely, he said. And I was rather shocked by that, because I wouldn't find that, personally, I wouldn't find it enjoyable. But people do. As far as I know, I wouldn't find it enjoyable. And I think they've been touched by that, taken over by that. They become, says the poem, true friends.
Can we try that microphone a bit? Can you put up the tone? Just
up here. There you go.
Can you?
Yeah.
You want this? No. That? What is that sound? That's all right. Not all right. What is it? Perhaps I should just shout very loud.
Is the volume too much?
What?
Is the volume too much?
Well, I think yeah. Some people say it's not enough.
Just move your mouth here, darling. It's not fine.
Change the second.
Yes. I don't know what to do.
Let's try putting it more. Let's try that.
What is that thing?
It's fine, fine.
Yeah.
If it's like that, then maybe.
Well, yeah, I think it seems like this. Stop me again if I don't work. They become true friends, and after that Namor is heard of the love of women in the poem. And soon we learn what is all leading up to. A serious assault on nature. Gilgamesh says, "Now we must travel to the cedar forest, where the fierce monster Humbaba lives. We must kill him and drive out evil from the world." See, we have this idea of evil coming in. And when you look at the word evil, most people use it for something which just blocks them, something that completely stops them, or something that they would like to have the world without. It's something to do with the coming of the overmighty ego. Why should he call the guardian of the forest evil? That's the question. He does. Humbaba has been set in the forest to guard it, set there by the gods. But he will get in Gilgamesh's way. So he has become an evil. And perhaps the concept evil, as I say, accompanies the arrival of the over-mighty ego and amounts to anything which blocks it. That, I think, is what Heraclitus means when he says, "For the gods all things are good and fair, but men have taken some things to be good and others evil." For Gilgamesh to conquer the sacred forest would be to assert his perfect, untrammeled freedom to act. It's what all warlords teach their men, you know, to outstep the boundaries of nature, especially in those forms of human kindness and mercy, because it gives an overwhelming advantage over those who haven't. That was largely what Hitler's ambition was. To take no prisoners is the final liberation, the final escape from the control of nature, the escape from the heart. It is symbolically achieved in the slaying of Humbaba. This is the crisis and turning point of the story. Enkidu at first begs him not to, but for the wrong reasons Enkidu is afraid. He knows the sweet-smelling cedars that pierce the sky. They are, of course, the cedars of Lebanon, by which the long famous, and of which there are some left. And stretch, he says, for 1,000 miles, and no man should enter there. Humbaba's breath spews fire. His voice booms like thunder. He can hear all sounds in the forest, even the faintest rustling among the leaves. He will hear us 100 miles away. But Gilgamesh tells him not to be a coward. And when Gilgamesh's own nerve fails, as it does along the way, Enkidu tells him that too. By this doubling up, you see, of the masculine, they can do anything, they think. They set off with a blessing of the city, a very different city to that described by Shamhat. Gilgamesh's mother herself commends them. She has accepted her role in the new order. In Superman style, at 400 miles, they stop for some food. 1,000 they pitch camp. Both of them have bad dreams, but the other one always manages to find a positive interpretation. When they meet Humbaba at last, after the initial boasting and threatening, which goes on, he realizes that they are serious, that they are a threat, that they are powerful. And he then wants to share the forest with them. And that would be the ideal solution. They can have all the wood they want, but don't kill him, he says. If you kill me, you'll bring the gods down upon you. And their judgment will be hard. And Gilgamesh, interestingly, would accept this argument. But Enkidu urges him on to the final blow. One of the taunts of Humbaba to Enkidu is that he never suckled at a woman's breast. He is perhaps a purer form of the archetypal masculine, even than Gilgamesh. Now he says, "Dear friend, quickly, before another moment goes by, kill Humbaba. Don't listen to his words. Don't hesitate. Slit his throat before the great god Enlil can stop us." So they continued. At his death roar, the mountains of Lebanon split. The valleys ran with his blood for 10 miles. The forest resounded. Then the two friends sliced him open, pulled out his intestines, cut off his head with its knife-sharp teeth and horrible bloodshed staring eyes. And then they take their axes and penetrate deeper into the forest. The wood chips flew. Gilgamesh chopped down the mighty trees. Enkidu hewed them into trunks, their trunks into timbers. Enkidu said, "By your great strength, you have killed Humbaba, the forest's watchman. What could bring you dishonor now? We have chopped down the trees of the cedar forest. We have brought to earth the highest of the trees, the cedar whose top pierced the skies." It is, of course, from the cedar forest that the rivers flow, which gave birth to the cities in the beginning. So the bell tolls for Sumer too. In a couple of thousand years, perhaps, the great cities with their libraries of clay tablets will have sunk below the sand. In the same period, the paradise of the whole Mediterranean world, which had taken nature so many millions of years to evolve, to prepare, will be on its way to that often very treeless zone that we see there. But now the friends have chopped down the highest tree, they're ready to go home. They build a raft and float down the river, Enkidu steering the way down, and Gilgamesh holding the great head, which they will lodge in the temple of some father god. And when they arrive, Gilgamesh washes the blood and the filth of battle off him, puts on fine clothes, and looks remarkably handsome. And the goddess sees what a fine man he is, and her loins, says the poem, catch fire. I think she makes the same sort of courtship that nature perpetually makes to us
with its beauty and that wisdom which is peculiarly its own. There's always an attempt at arranging and making that marriage between nature and the human, which the old culture understood very well, and the culture of Gilgamesh not at all. She is saying, what could we not do together, you and I? If only you could learn what Shamhat taught to Enkidu. They could restore the destruction done in the forest and all the other wounds inflicted upon nature. But Gilgamesh treats her as almost as roughly as Humbaba. A raging stream of insults is his reply to her proposal. The first is that she can't defend herself, and that's important, because remember that goddess culture, when it was attacked by enemies, actually couldn't defend itself. And that's why the kings arose. Because the enemy is now at the gate. He despises her weakness in the realm of battle. And that's behind the string of insults he starts off with. Why should I wish to be the lover of a broken oven that fails in the cold, a flimsy door that the wind blows through, a palace that falls on its staunchest defenders, a water skin that is full of holes and leaks all over its bearer, and so on and on in the same vein. Remember, this was the most sacred deity for thousands of years. The second is that her lovers die, and that's the real nub of the matter, because Gilgamesh in no way wants to die. Remember what happened, and all the myths of the lover, of the goddess and her lover, of course, is that the lover does die. It's the whole point of the story. Remember what happened to that beautiful boy, Tammuz. You loved him when you were both young, then you changed. You sent him to the underworld and doomed him to be wailed forever. You loved the bright speckled roller bird and so on through all the catalogue in Sumerian myth of the human lovers of the goddess. All of whom are loved by her just for the reason that they are mortal. Now, Jung was very interested in this theme. He thought that the gods needed us to become conscious, that the eternal cannot be conscious of itself, because it just doesn't have that limit in which consciousness can occur. And so he was, he thought in much the same way as this ancient culture did. And I consider him very much as the psychologist of nature. love, just because, for that reason, because they die, because they are part of that mortal world which knows time, the beginning and the end, the alpha and the omega, which the eternal can never know short of this intense and intimate union with a mortal. And that's what all mystical love is about, right through to our own time. There's no other way. That, of course, is why Zeus endlessly comes to human maidens. Doesn't get very far, usually. In the angel for Mary, and why all the beauties of the deep endlessly pull us down into the depths towards them. They want to breed with us, to produce that great new birth, which would be consciousness. The theme of what is repeats itself throughout the goddess myth. Now you know what a woman is. The mystery of being, but things are. Now you know what a woman is, says Shamhat to Enkidu. Now you know what it is to grieve, what it is to witness a birth, a coming into being. One day you will know a death, a going out. From both the birth and the death, both the grief and the joy, you understand the extraordinary thing that anything exists.
The ancient culture was built around the annually repeated marriage between two opposites, mortal and immortal. Between the goddess, who was their concept of the eternal, because mother, and the man who represented all that was born from her, all things that came to birth and then go back to her, including the human, in whom was this extraordinary potential of consciousness. And that knowing death was extremely important to them. And the goddess herself has to undergo it. Some of you will know the descent of Inanna into the underworld. She was the goddess of sunshine and flowers and the great sky and everything singing. But she had to go down to her dark sister in the underworld. She had to go down to the opposite. She had to become a dead piece of meat rotting on a hook in her sister's territory. Of course her lovers have to die. Of course they have to go to the underworld. They have to be conscious too, and they usually don't want to. That is why Tammuz has to die. If you want to be a lover of the goddess, you have to know death. No way, says Gilgamesh. Consciousness itself is not a concept that the patriarchy is interested in. Inanna is inviting him into consciousness. He doesn't want it. It's remarkable how utterly he's lost touch with the civilization of 2,000 years which went on before him, in which consciousness was the whole point. It's why so much of the temple literature consisted of the celebration of that union of sexuality as the metaphor, as it still is for mystical writing, of the union between the temporal and the eternal. Our own mystics knew that. The first temple at Uruk was built in 5000 BC and peaked at the same time as a wonderful building called New Grange in Ireland, which I will talk about later, where the sun comes up the passage into the inner chamber and fertilizes the new season. Each year it happens at the winter equinox. The main deity in the temple of the old culture was Inanna, the early name of the goddess. And the main ritual in the year was her marriage to a priest or king who represented, in a broad sense, all creation, but especially this beloved city. The marriage was enacted on the seventh day of the first moon after the winter solstice, when the soil was moist and ready for the seed, and the moon was in her boat shape, like that, which they thought was like a still unfilled vessel, an expectant womb, like the whole earth was. He approached her, the poem would always say, with lifted head. I think you're going to find this a bit difficult, because I think it's so far from anything that we think of as the sacred. We can puzzle about the image. I puzzled about the image with lifted head. And then suddenly clicked. It's how the bull comes to the cow. And if we're country boys and girls, if they all were, that's obvious. He is doing what the bull does. If she's ready, then it comes to him on the wind. All the images in this event are religious, and all are agricultural, part of that union of the human with the earth itself, earth herself. Notice that there are no metaphors for mystic love so good as those of nature. At the climax of the ceremony, the king goes with lifted head to the holy loins. Dumuzi goes with lifted head to the holy loins of Inanna. He lies down beside her on the bed. Tenderly he caresses her, murmuring words of love. O my holy jewel, O my wondrous Inanna. And she chants, my honey man sweetens me always. My lord, the honey man of the gods. He's the one my womb loves best. His hand is honey, his foot is honey. He sweetens me always. Now, when people discovered this poetry, not so long ago, they were immensely moved by its beauty and also a bit shocked. But honey, you see, is perhaps the best metaphor nature has for that fact, the sweetness of life, the fact of being. Honey, in its unique sweetness, is a sheer sweetness of that anything is, the mystery that the world is. Bees belong to the goddess. When she asked the man to plough her high fields and her wet ground, it was to liberate the power which is her very meaning, to create. In another poem, she leans back over an apple tree and admires her vulva, congratulates herself upon it because that is her power, and all the world comes out of that, although she needs the man for civilization. It's the power of creation, and it's completely unashamed. It's natural, it's where human and nature have still not been at war, have not poured, and the human hasn't poured negative propaganda upon nature. Gilgamesh rejects all this and treats the goddess with such disrespect that she sends against him and Enkidu the bull of heaven. And he and Enkidu together just pull the bull to pieces and throw the bloody haunches in her face. Also, they say, actually, you can't kill the bull of heaven. You can't call him Baba either. You can just cut off your connection to them. That's all you can do. They think they've killed it. They've killed it in themselves. The two friends then wash themselves in the river and return to the palace hand in hand. And Gilgamesh calls to his singing girls, tell me, who is the handsomest of men? Tell me, who is the bravest of heroes? Gilgamesh, he is the handsomest of men. Enkidu, he is the bravest of heroes. But the last card has still to be played. Enkidu dreams that they must die. They've offended the gods, and one of them must first die, and it will be him. Gilgamesh will know death in the loss of his friend, perhaps more than Enkidu will know it himself. And soon Enkidu takes sick. And death for him, you see, is no kind return to the mother, as it is in a natural culture. It's already one of those terrifying images, and like the great fire replete with little black demons who stoke it, that will deface all this culture's feeling for death and any afterlife it may have. Enkidu dreams that he is standing on a shadowy plain. A creature appeared with a lion's head. His face was ghastly. He had a lion's paws and eagle's talons and wings. He flew at me. He seized me by the hair. I tried to struggle, but with one blow he capsized me like a raft. He leaped upon me like a bull. He trampled my bones. Gilgamesh, save me, I cried. But you didn't save me. You were afraid, and you didn't come. And Gilgamesh is overcome, and suddenly is in a state of a heartbroken child. Bitterly he wept through the wilderness. He put on a lion skin and went out into the wilderness, which you did when you were ready mourning. Must I die too? Must I be as lifeless as Enkidu? How can I bear this sorrow that gnaws at my belly, this fear of death that restlessly drives me on? If only I could find the one man whom the gods made immortal, I would ask him how to overcome death. And the rest of his life, you see, the rest of the poem is about this futile, rather undignified, we might think, attempt to find eternal life, which of course he can't. The search of Western man has begun for that connection which we may well think he has himself destroyed. I didn't want to make it too long, but is there anybody who would like to talk it through now, a little bit? No hurry. Two more lectures on this, on other aspects of this myth.
May I ask you, please?
Sorry?
May I ask you, please?
Please.
Is the story of the flood, has that got anything to do with, you obviously haven't mentioned it today, but
it comes from the same poem, you see, because one of the things which Gilgamesh does to try and find the secret of eternal life is to go to something called Utnapishtim, which is the person that we call Noah, who built the ark and was given immortal life by the gods, they thought. And he goes to find Utnapishtim, and Utnapishtim tells him the whole story of the flood. So that's quite right. When they first discovered this parallel to the gospel, to the Bible story, there was tremendous excitement in Victorian circles that here was something from the Bible which actually was earlier, a lot earlier, 2,000 years earlier.
So possibly the Bible story was an adaptation of that story.
Well, what happens with myth, you know, is that sort of fragments get through to next generations. And when you have the drawing up of an official body, like the Bible, the people who are doing it choose from here and there. So that's how it happened, I think. Certainly, the Jews came up from Mesopotamia. It says in the Bible, Abraham came up from Ur of the Chaldees. And a great deal of that myth came with them. I think that Mesopotamia remained a pretty goddess-oriented culture, and too much for the taste of Abraham. I think they came up in order to make a purer patriarchy than they found there. Sorry?
May I also ask,
please?
I'm afraid my knowledge of the Gilgamesh epic is very limited.
Yeah.
I too have heard that some of the biblical facts had a precursor in these stories. Can you give us an idea whether there's something about the creation in the epic? And whether any other.
I don't think there is in this poem, no. No, I don't think so. You see, there's a huge amount of stuff to be translated still. There are 120,000 tablets in the British Museum alone. 120,000, they've been there. And slowly people are going through translating stuff.
I don't know.
So we don't know what will eventually come to light. But less than half of it has.
Thank you. Sorry about that.
Yes?
Say something more about patriarchy not being interested in consciousness.
I think it's the case, you see, that many other things have more value in a patriarchy. For example, obedience. Obedience becomes to take the supreme virtue, supreme point of life, because if you are obedient, then God will give you consciousness, but it will be in the next world. I think that's a fundamental difference to the fact that to the idea that this life is where, in fact, we have to create consciousness. Well, I think the framework in which we were all brought up was that if you are obedient, you do what God tells you to do through His church, then you will be taken into heaven afterwards, and then you will have to develop the vision of God. But that will be the next world, and it will be because you are obedient rather than because you've made consciousness in this world. Obedience becomes the highest virtue, obedience duty. Yes?
Was there a conscious the concept of heaven in those, particularly in that era?
I think not.
So what happened when you died?
Well, I think you see that in the goddess culture, we're going back to the mother, we're going back into nature. No reason to think it's a horrible place.
Is it possible for you to provide us with some extracts from the epic tomorrow, or must we all go and look them up for ourselves?
Well, there's a wonderful book, a translation by Stephen Mitchell, which I'm sure you can get hold of easily enough. It's called The Myth of Gilgamesh. Stephen Mitchell. I am going to give out some notes. Tomorrow there will be notes available of this lecture. And there will be other notes subsequent, the two others. Stephen Mitchell is the person, and it's a lovely rendition. I think he published in 2004. Mitchell. Sorry. Well, you see, it changed a great deal because before the kings came, before 3000 BC, there was the temple had been founded about 2000 years earlier, in 5000 BC. And the main deity there was the goddess. And that lasted, I think, until the coming of war, you see. And when war came, then the goddess wasn't much use. And then you had a complete change to a whole lot of male gods in the next 500 or 600 years. Sula totally changed. Did that answer? Yes?
Could you stretch a point out of what you've said today and draw a sort of parallel between Gilgamesh, who chops down the highest tree, with Adam, who eats the tree of knowledge, and at which point, more or less, and the goddess could be God, eternal. And at a certain point, Gilgamesh and his partner have become conscious, or there's a separation between them and, as you said, the instinct of animals as compared with the consciousness of man and the awareness, where they have an awareness in the same way as Adam and Eve become aware of themselves and also of their mortality. Because while they are in the Garden of Eden, they're immortal. So in a way that you could say that the creation story possibly, at a stretch, has got some kind of parallel with this story which preceded it.
I think that leaving the garden is the great parallel. I think it is a very fundamental myth.
Well, they left the forest.
I think it's certainly, yeah. I think, what is very patriarchal about the Eden myth there is that it's only done because of disobedience.
Yeah.
chapter. Oh, yes.
Can you say anything about who the invaders were?
The invaders, it's all a bit shrouded in mystery, but they came from the huge hinterlands of Central Asia. And they had not known agriculture, and they had not had the psychological development that comes with agriculture. They were herders and they were hunters. And they were quite simple people compared, but very good at fighting. And actually all over Old Europe, and I'll be talking about Old Europe quite a lot tomorrow, but the same thing, the same sort of civilization went down about 3,000 BC. Including our stone-lined people, who I'm very interested in, the people who built Stonehenge and all that other. All over Europe, in fact. That culture, you see, was very like the pre-king culture.